Okay, it's a pleasure to be here today. I've learned this week everything I wanted to know about type 1a supernovae and perhaps a little more. I wanted to also particularly thank the organizers for giving me the very valued third to last slot in the schedule. So the work I'm going to describe today is really the work of my PhD student, Brian Metzger, who's literally at this moment somewhere between Iowa and Princeton driving to start a postdoc position in Princeton, but he really did a lot of the work that I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to largely focus on this question of trying to understand the late time activity of the central engine in short duration gamma ray bursts. So Ido already very nicely laid the stage for that in a relatively large fraction of short GRBs, we see activity on hundreds of seconds of timescales, which is pretty puzzling given the intrinsic timescales of the phenomena. Along the way, because the physics turns out to be quite similar, the physics of the accretion disk in short duration gamma ray bursts turns out to have quite a bit of similarity to physics that operates in the context of accretion-induced collapse of a white dwarf to a neutron star. I'll also talk a little bit about the formation of unusual supernovae from accretion-induced collapse. And so just to reiterate some of the points that Ido already made, one of the leading models, in fact, the predicted model for short-duration gamma ray bursts is that they can be produced by compact object mergers. We know in our galaxy there are neutron star neutron star binaries that will merge within a Hubble time. Similarly, neutron star black hole mergers. These are interesting for a wide variety of reasons, not the least of which is that they're the primary target for kilometer scale gravitational wave observatories. So the merger of two neutron stars produces perhaps a transient supermassive neutron star supported by differential rotation, but that will relatively quickly collapse to form a black hole. In addition to the black hole, the merger leaves behind a disk of material, and the mass in that torus of material around the black hole depends on the properties of the progenitor systems. It can range from anything from basically zero mass left behind to maybe a few tenths of a solar mass left in the disk. And it was noticed already back in the late 80s and early 90s that the natural time scale to accrete onto a newly formed black hole in compact object mergers is a second or a tenth of a second, fully consistent with the time scales of short duration gamma ray bursts. And so this is actually one of the strong motivations for associating compact object mergers with short duration GRBs. The physics here in these disks is actually rather similar to some of the stuff that Andrew talked about. Neutrino cooling is irrelevant because the densities are so high. Instead, the disks largely cooled by neutrinos. So one of the real puzzles, very interesting puzzles raised by Swift observations, is the fact that in at least a quarter, and potentially actually in all short duration gamma ray bursts, there's a significant amount of energy coming out on timescales of 100 seconds or so, not the canonical tenth of a second timescale. And this takes a couple of different forms. There are these short bursts with extended emissions where you have the initial flare that corresponds to the canonical short burst, but then followed by this soft emission on 30 to 100 second timescales. There are also flares that can be on hour or day timescales. And as Ido already emphasized, these are not energetically insignificant. There are bursts where the energy coming out in this late time event can be 10 times that of the initial prompt spike. And this is a very interesting problem in the context of compact object mergers because the natural time scales, as I already emphasized, are really milliseconds to maybe a tenth of a second, not 100 seconds. So where does that long time scale come from? Well, so look at this. I'm going to talk a little bit about the physics of the accretion disk and how it evolves. So you have the merger, you form a new black hole with some material around it. That material starts to accrete onto the central object, and as it accretes by angular momentum conservation, the material moves out and spreads out to larger radii. And so that's shown here in this very sophisticated one-dimensional simulation that you're seeing from all these different viewing angles, but you can't tell because it's one-dimensional. So this just shows literally the viscous spreading of the material. This is the mass in the disk as a function of radius. It spreads out in time. As it spreads in time, it cools. So one thought is that maybe the late time activity is just this natural viscous evolution of accretion disks that we've known about since the early work by Pringle, Lin, et cetera. And in fact, if you plot up in one of these models, what is the energy available from accretion as a function of time in this spreading disk, it actually doesn't decrease very rapidly in time. It just decreases as a power law as about t to the minus 1/3. So in principle, it looks like there's a fair bit of energy available at 100 seconds to explain the late time activity. And that turns out, however, to be incorrect. And the reason it's incorrect is that there's a lot more interesting physics happens as this disk is spreading and cooling. So initially, when the disk is close to the central object, it's hot, and it's sufficiently hot that it radiates energy away by neutrinos. As it spreads and cools, it's no longer able to radiate energy by neutrinos. It's continually being heated by viscous processes in the disk, and that energy serves to unbind most of the material at late times. So when you transition from neutrino-cooled to not neutrino-cooled on a tenth of a second or a second time scale, most of the material actually becomes unbound. It's unbound not only by the natural viscous evolution of the disk, but in fact, on about this 10th to 1 second time scale, originally you just had neutrons and protons in the disk. As it spreads, they start to recombine into helium. That releases enough energy to unbind the disk. So when you take that into account, the fact that almost all of the material is blown away starting on about a tenth of a second time scale, there's simply insufficient energy to explain late time activity from compact object mergers from accretion of the initial disk. The only real caveat to that, I think, is deus ex machina. Just say that the viscosity in the disk is so low that everything happens on 100-second time scales. This is not particularly natural, given our understanding of the problem. Okay, so it's really not the initial disk that's producing this late time activity. So now is the interlude, or intermezzo, or however you want to think about it. I want to change gears slightly and talk a little bit about accretion-induced collapse of a white dwarf to a neutron star. And the reason for this is that, in fact, all of the physics that I just described to you, with one very important exception, happens, we think, during accretion-induced collapse of a white dwarf to a neutron star. So this is some of the very nice simulation work by Adam Burrows and Luc Desart, where they take a rapidly rotating oxygen-neon-magnesium white dwarf. It undergoes electron captures. It collapses to form a neutron star. Here is an example of the density as a function of radius in the central few hundred kilometers after collapse in one of their simulations. This is the neutron star, but the neutron star is surrounded by this huge torus of material, just like the black hole created in neutron star mergers. And the reason is very simple. The white dwarf, prior to collapse, we think, is going to be rapidly rotating, so some of the material as it collapses gets centrifugally hung up. So this setup, with the exception of having a neutron star instead of a black hole, is essentially the same setup I just talked about. So just to remind you, we don't really know what the AIC rate is. There are a variety of indirect arguments that suggest it's probably not much more than a percent or so of the 1A rate, but this is pretty uncertain. In the calculations that Adam and Luke and others have done, the initial explosion, okay, after the collapse to a neutron star, that unbinds the outer parts of the white dwarf, but that is a truly weak explosion. It has a mass in nickel, which is less than 10 to the minus 3 solar masses or so. The energy in the explosion is 3 times 10 to the 49, maybe up to 10 to the 50 ergs. So these are very, very weak explosions. But what we also have, the physics that's not captured in their simulations, is the long-term evolution of this disk of material left around the neutron star. And that does exactly the same thing that I just told you. This disk starts to accrete onto the neutron star. Initially, neutrinos radiate, cool the disk. Eventually, however, as the disk spreads out, it can no longer radiate away its binding energy by neutrinos. It's The initial white dwarf material was broken down into free nucleons. As the disk spreads, those free nucleons recombine to form helium and heavy elements, and you blow apart the disk. Same story as before, with one key difference. The key difference is now this disk that's spreading and unbinding is irradiated by the central neutron star, which is radiating 10 to the 52 ergs per second in neutrinos, as we've heard. That completely changes the composition of the disk. In a neutron star merger, this material that's unbound is basically almost entirely neutrons, 70% neutrons, 30% electrons, just because you're starting from neutron-rich material. Here, you're starting from neutron-rich material in this disk, or actually, you're starting from material that was initially about equal neutrons and protons from the white dwarf. It becomes neutron-rich in the disk, but then it's illuminated by all these electron neutrinos. And those take this material that's being blown away and convert it back to roughly equal numbers of neutrons and protons. So now I have this unbound material undergoing nuclear fusion, equal numbers of neutrons and protons. That gives me nickel. And so the prediction is that however much material is in this disk initially, an interestingly large fraction, a third to a half of that material, should be unbound in the form of nickel. Now, how much nickel gets out depends on how much material's in the disk initially. That depends on details of the progenitor that we don't understand. But it could plausibly be for some of the progenitors that Adam did, we found about 0.02 solar masses of nickel ejected in this wind. It could be 10 to the minus 3 solar masses if the initial disk is a little bit more wimpy. So what is this going to do? Well, it's going to give you an interesting supernovae, a supernovae whose signature, I think, is that in addition to the nickel and potentially other iron group elements, there are also some neutron-rich elements left over from this disk, elements like this. And this amount of nickel is potentially quite a bit brighter than the explosion that Adam and others find of the white dwarf initially. So this blowing out of the nickel-rich material at late times may well dominate the emission we see from accretion-induced collapse. So we've started to actually calculate light curves and spectra, relatively more realistic. This is with a nuclear engineering student who decided he wanted to do nuclear astrophysics instead of laboratory nuclear engineering. So he's working with Peter Nugent, Dan Kaysen, and myself to actually calculate light curves and spectra. This just shows you a range of examples where we take the same total mass, the same amount of nickel, but put in different amounts of these other elements that we expect to be there. And what you get is a supernovae with a peak luminosity of, say, 3 by 10 to the 41 ergs per second, very rapid rise on daytime scales, and then something that lasts maybe a few days to 5 days, depending on the exact composition of the material. And as you already heard from Avishai Galyam and others, there are some interesting, unusual supernovae which have the potential to be associated with this kind of event. I don't want to make that claim very strongly now, but I think it's a very interesting possibility that we're exploring in more detail. Okay, intermezzo done. Back to compact object mergers. So remember where we were in the compact object merger story. We had this funky, very late time, 100-second emission that we could not understand from the natural evolution of the accretion disk form in compact object mergers. So what does that leave us with? Well, one very interesting possibility that's been suggested, as Ito already mentioned, is that during the merger of two neutron stars, or a neutron star and a black hole, you not only form this disk of material around the black hole, but you also shed material in kind of tidal tails. And that material gets flung off onto eccentric orbits with a wide range of initial periods. And so the prediction, these are some calculations by Stephen Roswog, the prediction is that there should be fallback at late time, similar to the fallback that Andrew McFadyen talked about in the collapsar context. Power law fallback, maybe T to the minus 5/3, roughly, fallback of material at late times. So there is at least plausibly enough mass and energy falling back on 100-second timescales to explain at least some of the late-time emission from short-duration GRBs. But this certainly doesn't look anything like the kinds of phenomena we're seeing here, initial spike, big gap, and then some late-time emission. It's clearly what we're seeing observationally is not a continuous power law. And so what I want to describe to you is why this prediction of a pure power law decline in the fallback rate at late times is actually not correct. And it's not correct simply because there's physics that's missing from these calculations. And that physics is the nucleosynthesis that takes place in this ejecta. So we already talked about how in the case of a supernovae or in the case of accretion-induced collapse, if we have roughly equal numbers of electrons and protons, an electron fraction of a half, we can produce iron group elements like nickel. On the other hand, when we have a neutron star merger and we eject neutron star material in this tidal debris, we're very neutron rich. We in fact don't have that much electrons. We have an electron fraction of maybe a tenth or so. And those conditions are very good for producing neutron-rich elements that we see in nature. In fact, this was one of the original motivations for David Eichler, Latimer, and Schramm for studying neutron star mergers was to understand the possible production of neutron-rich elements. All right, so really what I want to talk about now is what effect this nucleosynthesis has on the fallback material in compact object mergers. So if you've ever been a student at Harvard or Berkeley and had the pleasure to either teach or take a class from the great lecturers, Bob Kirshner and Alex Filipenko, you've heard them proclaim loudly, potentially while dancing around the stage, that there's a fundamental distinction between nucleosynthesis before the iron peak and above the iron peak. These are big words, and Berkeley undergrads are okay with this. I'm not sure about Harvard undergrads. There's this whole exothermic, endothermic thing where these reactions over here ostensibly don't release energy. Yes, you do say that, I recall. So that's actually not right. If I start from free neutrons over here, free neutrons and nuclei over here and end up with something very bound over here, I actually release a lot of energy. So this nucleosynthesis, the R process starting from neutron-rich material, actually releases a very interesting amount of energy. It's a few MeV per nucleon, comes out largely in beta decays and a little bit of fission. This energy is not captured in current merger simulations at a minimum because they don't go long enough to see energy released and in practice because they don't have this physics in their calculations. So a few MeV per nucleon is a really interesting number compared to the binding energy of material falling back at late times. So these tidal tails, the material have very, very large semi-major axes, so they're weakly bound. You can express that by saying that the binding energy for material that nominally would come back on a second time scale is about an MeV per nucleon. And so clearly, this R process can have a huge effect on the late time fallback on second time scales. So just to give you an example of what this looks like, we collaborated with some nuclear physicists who actually do these R process calculations. These show some sample density trajectories for this unbound material with different initial orbital periods. This is the heating due to the R process as a function of time. So the heating happens on about a second time scale. You inject this MeV per nucleon on about a second time scale due to beta decays after these neutron-rich elements are created. So you can actually calculate in our models what is the total energy supplied by our process heating as a function of initial orbital period. So initially, the material goes out and comes back so fast that it doesn't get very much our process heating because the heating takes a second time scale. The orbital period is about a tenth of a second initially, so not much happens. As you go to longer orbital periods, you have more time for our process, and after about a second time scale, you inject enough energy by this R process heating that you can unbind material that would otherwise fall back. So what does this do? Well, what we expected going into this project is that this would completely suppress the late time fallback of material after about a second time scale. And that might still be the right answer, but it's actually a little bit more subtle than that. And so what we did is we developed a toy model, literally an analytic toy model that you can solve in four lines of code. So not a big fancy hydrodynamic calculation. We developed a toy model to take into account what happens to this heating, what it does to the fallback rate at late times. And here are three examples of the fallback rate as a function of time when we take into account this our process heating that happens on different time scales. So if the heating happens on a very short time scale, that's the dotted line, a tenth of a second, that's the wrong answer, but were that to be the right answer, what would happen is very simple. If you just put in a delta function of energy at some time, you just shift material that was very bound and you make it a little less bound. And you don't really interrupt this power law decline in the fallback rate at late times. On the other hand, if you inject the energy on like a 3-second time scale, then you have this very interesting feedback effect where material that was going out on one orbital period gets moved to a slightly longer orbital period because of the heating. On a longer orbital period, it gets more heating, so it moves to a longer orbital period. It gets more heating, there's a runaway, and the material becomes completely unbound. And so if the R process heating happens on 3-second time scales, there's no fallback after about a second or so. But there's a very interesting intermediate regime about 0.8 seconds or so for the R process heating, where there's a cutoff and then a resumption in the fallback on late time scales, on about 10-second time scales. So what do our numerical calculations give? They give something very close to this. And so it's natural to speculate that maybe this can account for the lack of a power law in late times in short gamma ray bursts. Maybe there's an unbinding or more precisely, a heating of material that would have fallen back on 1 second, but instead falls back on 10-second timescales. Now, this is fine-tuned. I already showed you that this only happens in a very narrow range of parameters. But there's fine-tuned and there's fine-tuned, right? If nature gives you those numbers, that's the answer. Okay, and so right now it looks like this is a very real possibility that you can produce a gap in the fallback due to nucleosynthesis in the ejecta. But our calculations are very simple, and so really we need to do more sophisticated hydrodynamic calculations to look at this. And in particular, I think one real puzzle still is the point that I emphasized and Ito emphasized, which is how do you explain the fact there's so much energy coming out at late timescales? So if it turns out that the right answer is that the R process completely suppresses fallback after about a second time scale, I think we're in an extremely interesting situation that the most natural and promising progenitor channel cannot produce activity on hundreds of second time scales. And that might really suggest that there are multiple populations of short GRB. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this develops in the next few years. And since I'm already over time, I'll just leave up my summary and be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks a lot, Elliot. Elliot, I think it's a very important potential scenario. So, I have a question from Chris.
So, I don't know Stefan's code exactly, but a lot of our codes have, as part of the equation, say, an NSC network.
Right.
And that would get some of the energy there.
Correct.
So, how's that?
Right. Good? No, I know what you're talking about. So there is some of this heating is clearly captured in the merger simulation. So there's two issues that are important there. Here's the timescale plot again of energy released by our process as a function of initial orbital period. Okay, these are the timescales of seconds is what we're interested on this logarithmic plot. This is the duration of the merger simulations, 30 milliseconds. So there's no way they're capturing second timescale heating. Equally importantly, What this model shows is that there's a fundamental difference between heating on 30 millisecond timescales and heating on a second timescale. Heating on 30 millisecond timescales just takes bound material, makes it a little bit less bound. You don't have this feedback effect where material that's on one orbit gets pushed to a longer orbit that gives it more heating, that pushes it to a longer orbit. And so what we really need to do to understand this is to do hydrodynamic calculations that include at least approximate models for this long timescale heating. But that's a good question.
Hi, Elliot. So you mentioned that if you have an alpha less than 10 to the minus 3, that this might be an alternative solution.
Yes.
And that's not that far off from canonical values for alpha disks. And since we don't really know the viscosities in the disks, can you just elaborate a little bit on why you think that's...
Right. No, that's a good question. So I would say, from the theoretical side, we don't know alpha. You may have heard the contrary from MHD simulations, but the truth is, that's a very difficult thing to predict. On the other hand, I would say, from the phenomenology of soft X-ray transients, dwarf novae, et cetera, at least when disks are hot enough to be fully ionized, the best guess is that alpha is around a tenth. 10 to the minus 3 might be appropriate for neutral disks like planet-forming disks, but not for hot, fully ionized disks. The second thing I would say is that this time scale, this spike, is naturally reproduced by an alpha of about 10th during a compact object merger or during accretion-induced collapse. But if alpha were really 10 to the minus 3, then the only timescales in town would be tens of second timescales. And so it would be very difficult to produce this. So I think what you need to do, if you want to explain this by a very low alpha, is you have to have some of the material have a high alpha to give you a big spike, and some have low alpha to give you long timescale. That's very, very artificial to my mind, but you know, maybe.
I was intrigued by your intermezzo on AIC.
Yes.
Particularly the suggestion that you might generate some supernovae, or supernova-like events this way. In work that we're about to post with Eric Fall and with Harvard graduate student Robert Harris, we're considering AIC in both the pregenitors and postgenitors, where in single degenerate models, the progenitor would be a super soft source. And because you then have this neutron star that continues to accrete matter, you have actually a very high luminosity, possibly an ultra-luminous X-ray source in the final state. Now, if you're correct, mm-hmm. in between that, you have a supernova.
Right.
So the neat thing about that would be you can actually test it because you'd have the supernova followed by an epoch of X-ray emission consistent with an X-ray binary,
right.
accreting neutron star.
Right. Now,
so
that would
be a wonderfully testable scenario.
I agree. That would have to be presumably a relatively close galaxy.
Well, it would have, yes, I mean,
so we have to get really lucky. So the other comment I would say, I think a very interesting thing that we're thinking of, I'll leave that up for a second. The other thing we're thinking about is the parenthetical comment here. So for instance, if you have a white dwarf merger, which gives rise to AIC, then this ejected material might run into the remnants of the white dwarf merger. And that's actually, I think, very important potentially. It might elongate the time scale for this event, and it might change the nucleosynthesis that you see. So I think that's a very interesting possibility to look into in some more detail.
Elliot, I'm wondering about the shape of the flare light curve. In your MDOT plot, it looks like you kind of go back up to 5/3 and then should decline like that.
Yes, that's right.
So is that in the data? Or?
What Andrew is referring to is that the prediction here is what you basically do is you take material that had some energy and you just shift it over. You don't change the time scale, you just introduce a gap. So you still get T to the minus 5/3 at late times. Now, as you perfectly know, going from a fallback rate to a gamma ray flux is fraught with uncertainties in jet production, emission physics, etc. So I don't know how to go from this to a prediction. I haven't heard for short bursts, I haven't heard any claim of T to the minus 5/3 at late times. There is some work by Davide Lazzotti and others in the context of long bursts, arguing that the late time activity might follow some power law like that. I don't know if Ido wants to. Yeah, so I think that's it would be an interesting thing to look at, I agree.
And I take one last question by David.
Okay, I'm going to phrase this question in the form of a deliberately provocative comment. The last two talks have worked very hard trying to explain these X-ray tails to short bursts. Until they were discovered, everybody thought the short bursts were different because they were short. And now these X-ray tails look suspiciously like X-ray flashes, which look suspiciously like gamma ray bursts, except that they're
in galaxies.
Except that they're softer.
And they are in galaxies with no star formation in some cases.
That's right.
There's one right outside an elliptical that looks like it's in the middle of the IGM.
That's right. That's part of my comment.
Yep.
So that means that the progenitors of the short bursts and the long bursts are probably different, but it doesn't mean that the black hole on a much more compact scale and the accretion disk immediately surrounding it is necessarily knows whether it had this giant envelope at 10^11 centimeters or not.
But I just showed you that it does, because it matters whether there's a that changes the nucleosynthesis, it changes the physics. So, I mean, I agree with you.
No. That's in your opinion, in your theory, but...
No, actually, that's physics, but...
let me finish my question,
okay.
Because it has nothing to do with that. The question is there any observational evidence that short bursts are different from long bursts in terms of the black hole accretion disk activity? I mean, maybe they both have the same time scale, but they appear to be different in spectra and in other details,
right,
because of viewing angle.
So I think the biggest difference is the host galaxy differences that Ido talked about. I mean,
but that's just the point. When you're seeing something without a massive envelope, you're much more likely to be seeing it from a wider viewing angle than when it does have a massive envelope, in which case the only way you could see it is when you're looking down the pipe.
So
there's a natural selection in viewing angles between the host galaxies, the two types of host galaxies.
So I certainly agree. I think the possibility that a different progenitor is implied is extraordinarily interesting. Now, what is that different progenitor is not clear. I think from what we've heard, it seems very difficult for it to be a massive star, which is what we think the progenitors for long bursts are. So that leaves us with the question of how can we produce a similar central engine while having fundamentally a different progenitor, not a massive star versus a massive star. One possibility would be, for example, that you get neutron stars either from core collapse or from accretion-induced collapse. Another possibility is you get black holes either from core collapse or neutron star mergers. And what we're trying to do is explore precisely whether you can get the same high energy phenomenology, okay, in the context of an intrinsically similar central engine. And what this work is showing is that it's actually not trivial to get the late time activity in the context of neutron star mergers. While fallback onto a black hole during core collapse does not face this problem. It is not neutron-rich material. It's fundamentally different physics. So this late-time fallback, which is what almost everybody wants to appeal to, Andrew, myself, what people want to appeal to explain the late-time activity, behaves fundamentally differently whether you're dealing with electrons, equal numbers of electrons and protons, or neutron-rich material. That's really the point. And so there is a difference, that means, in how the central engine seems to behave.
All right, so I think we have to move on. So thanks, Elliot, very much. So next speaker is Chris Fryer, who will speak about W.